This is the Late Round Podcast with your host, JJ Zacharisa. JJ Zacharisa.
What's up, everyone? It's JJ Zacharyson, the editor-in-chief over at NumberFire.com, and this is episode 114 of the Late Round Podcast, one of the many shows that are part of the NumberFire Podcast Network. Thanks for tuning in. I've got nothing to really rant about this week, but before getting into today's mailbag show that's filled with great questions submitted by you guys, I wanted to let you know about a SeatGeek offer for all Late Round Podcast listeners. Buying tickets can be complicated and confusing, but there's a better way to buy, and that's with SeatGeek. SeatGeek is the smartest, easiest way to get tickets to every type of live event. And best of all, Late Round Podcast listeners get $20 off their first SeatGeek purchase. Just download the SeatGeek app and enter promo code LATE today. That's promo code LATE for $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. This first question comes from Twitter from @chanwag3. Is Eric Ebron's age-adjusted production enough to still say that, quote, productive NFL tight end is within his range of outcomes? Or is, quote, he's just not good, period, a valid take to the point where he should be written off with no hope of ever being good for fantasy? So evidently, this tweet was the result of a debate amongst friends, and each of those friends listened to this podcast. So this is a lot of pressure on me, guys. Let me first say that this question came in before Ebron signed with the Colts. Whether that impacts how you view this, I don't know, but I felt like I needed that to be said. Now, I sent a tweet out a week and a half ago that said, most tight end receptions through their age 24 season in NFL history. Number one, Tony Gonzalez, 261. Jason Witten was number two. Rob Gronkowski was number three. Kellen Winslow was number four. And there's Eric Ebron sitting at number five on the list of most tight end receptions through their age 24 season in NFL history. And it's true. It's a fact. I didn't send it to say that Eric Ebron is as good as those guys. I sent it because it's a hilarious nugget. And I soon found out that there are a lot of people who hate Eric Ebron, especially after Ebron himself retweeted that tweet. My mentions were, as the kids say, very lit, and they were lit with people who were very triggered by a meaningless stat. I was called many names for stating that Eric Ebron has the fifth most receptions by a tight end before age 25. But hey, that's Twitter, I guess. Age-adjusted numbers do matter, though. There's been a lot of work done on how breakout age at the college level correlates to success in the NFL. That's not to say that age is as important once they are actually in the NFL, but a 22-year-old wide receiver going for 1,200 yards in a season is far more impressive than a 26-year-old one doing the exact same thing, even if both are playing in their second NFL seasons. Naturally, the Ebron nugget, and I don't know why I keep calling them nuggets, but let's just run with it, has just as much to do with opportunity as anything else. Through four NFL seasons, Eric Ebron has seen 288 targets. Since they counted targets in 1992, according to Pro Football Reference, seven tight ends have seen that type of volume before 25. To be fair, though, Ebron has more receptions than Todd Heap and Jeremy Shockey did on a similar amount of volume. They actually saw more volume through age 24 than Eric Ebron saw. But even when you remove age from the equation, Eric Ebron ranks 21st in tight end receptions through a tight end's first four NFL seasons, and he's 25th in touchdowns. To say this is only an age thing would be kind of silly. And to those of you who think that this is just a volume-driven thing, while you might be right with Ebron, overall, volume is still a skill statistic. We don't always view it that way because of fantasy football, but it is. Sure, there's going to be times where a bad receiver sees a lot of targets because the rest of the team's depth chart sucks. But think about what needs to happen in order to see a target, in order for a player to be targeted. A player has to make a football team. Then, he has to see a football field and be at least a part-time starter for that team. Then he has to actually get open when he's on a football field against a bunch of professional athletes. And then he has to be open enough where his quarterback throws him the ball. To say that no skill is involved in getting a target is foolish. And look, I'm not defending Ebron to the point where I think that he's a surefire NFL starter. And I think that he could have found a lot better of a spot for his short-term production than Indianapolis. But you don't rank where he ranks through his first four NFL seasons among tight ends, regardless of era, on accident. And that's before we even do any age adjusting. To be honest, this is a classic case of failing to meet expectations and people overreacting to it. I saw a tweet this week from Curtis Patrick, or @CPatrickNFL on Twitter, comparing Greg Olsen's numbers through his first four seasons versus Eric Ebron's. And those numbers were nearly identical. Granted, it's not an apples-to-apples comparison given the era, but it's still interesting. And Olsen, as Curtis noted, left Chicago after 4 years, and then he broke out in Carolina in year six. And the way that people view Eric Ebron right now is a lot harsher than how they viewed Greg Olsen when he went to Carolina. And it's not just because of Ebron's hands and people overstating the impact of drops. It's that Ebron was a super high pick in the NFL draft, and he's failing to live up to the hype. Olsen was the 31st overall pick, but Eric Ebron was 10th. I think if we had these numbers from Ebron, but he was a third rounder, let's say, then all of a sudden we're not even talking about him, quote, not being good, period. That's what the question is asking here. Eric Ebron is fine. He'll probably never hit his true ceiling, but let's stop with this he's not good stuff. You don't do what he did while not being good. This next one's also from Twitter, from @SmithBK. He says, I started Goff in a championship-winning lineup. Is anything possible, or was that a historic outlier in coaching change? Any effect on your fantasy football worldview? So I asked Brian, who sent this tweet, if he was just referring to Goff's general career progression from his rookie season to this past year, and he said, yes, that's what he's referring to. I've talked about Goff a lot on this show, like probably too much. But I've talked about him a lot because I was wrong about him entering last year, and I don't want to hide from my mistakes. I want to see what went wrong and why it went wrong and get better. I want to be a better analyst. I didn't give the Sean McVay impact enough love last offseason because I didn't think a coach could impact an offense this much. But I also don't think that it was just coaching, you guys. The team really improved their offensive line over the offseason, and they added not just weapons, but the right weapons in that offense. Now, with that being said, Jared Goff also saw the biggest year-over-year leap in adjusted net yards per attempt that we've ever seen in NFL history. And I'm not just talking about rookie season to sophomore season either. I'm saying take one season by a 200-plus attempt passer and then compare it to his next one, and Jared Goff's difference in adjusted net yards per attempt is the greatest that we've ever seen in NFL history. Because of that, I think that we have to say that not his season, but his season within the context of his rookie season was an outlier. Going into last year, I noted that we would see a better Jared Goff. It was almost impossible to see a worse Jared Goff than what we saw with Jared Goff under Jeff Fisher. But the jump we saw was indeed historic. So did it change the way I view things? Yeah, I think that I'm more open to crazy things happening based on massive personnel changes and coaching changes. I said as much earlier this offseason on my Things That I Missed podcast. Even still, I do think that we're in store for slight regression for Goff in 2018. Not only is there now a year of this offense for teams to game plan around a bit more, but Goff himself had a far above average touchdown rate last year of 5.9%. The league average is about a percentage and a half point lower than that, which would result in 6 or 7 fewer passing touchdowns for Goff this season if he had the same number of attempts. This next one's an email. It says, hey JJ, love the show and love the content. I enjoy the high level look at fantasy from a process standpoint. Thanks. I'm in a highly competitive 10-team standard league, and we do a live draft every year, before which we egg last year's loser. We're going into the 7th year, and every year we tweak the rules slightly in an effort to improve the league. Every year, the topic of converting to PPR comes up, and I can tell the majority of the guys think that it's the better format. However, we keep detailed records, most points by a team, player, win-loss, etc., which are highly heralded at each draft. Were we to switch to PPR, many of these records would immediately be broken. How do you balance the tradition of a league versus the desire to have it evolve? Tom. I mean, Tom, I think that this is the same thing that leagues run into all the time. Like professional leagues. In baseball, things aren't apples to apples from what happened in 1960 and what's happening today. In football, it used to be unheard of to have multiple 4,000-yard passers. We had 8 of them in 2017, which was a down year for quarterbacks due to injury, while in 2002, there were only 3 of them. And not only that, you could argue that with the increase in overall offense, scoring fantasy points is just easier these days than it was 15 years ago, so your records are already skewed a bit. Basically, Tom, you've got to weigh the importance of a more enjoyable league with the new rules versus these historical records. And you can always just have records before PPR and after PPR as well. I wouldn't let that get in the way of you changing any rules. This next question says, do you think the Browns should take a quarterback at number 1 and number 4? This increases the odds of hitting, and if both are great, they can trade one later. Thoughts? Thanks again for being the elite fantasy football podcast, Dave. Thank you, Dave. Now, I've seen this suggested a good bit across social media platforms, and while it falls into the bucket of my probability-driven thinking, I don't think it's a reasonable thing to do in the NFL. And it's because simply judging which quarterback is better wouldn't be a very easy thing to do. Like, how long until you cut ties with one of them? When do you officially know which one is better? How do you handle the quarterback competition in general? While I do think we have a general idea if a quarterback is good or not pretty early on in their careers, development still takes some time. And then there's the fact that the Browns would essentially be spending a pretty high spot on one position, and even if that position is totally worthwhile, which it is, if both of those players bust, then they're even more screwed than they would otherwise be. And like I said, I think that it would take a long time before they definitely know which quarterback was good and which one wasn't. It's not like fantasy football where we know if a running back is going to be a worthwhile starter in a season versus another one, because that can happen fairly early in one season. I think the idea is a smart one, but to actually execute properly without making a mistake would be really, really difficult to do. And I definitely don't trust Hugh Jackson to lead that charge. This next one says, "Hey JJ, I'm doing a dynasty league for the first time next season and was curious how to approach quarterbacks in the draft. It's going to be a 12-team, 25-man roster with one quarterback, two running backs, two wide receivers, one tight end, and two or three flex spots in the lineup. There are no kickers and defenses. It's a new league, so I don't know exactly how everyone will be playing, but my assumption is that most, if not all, starting quarterbacks will be rostered, making streaming very difficult. I also know quarterbacks have much more longevity. Normally in redraft, I'm a big proponent of the late-round quarterback strategy. I hope I draft a stud, and if I don't, I just stream the position. However, in this format, I can't really do that. Does it make more sense to use a higher round pick on a quarterback or draft three guys that would normally be considered streamers and stream from within my roster? Thanks again and love the podcast, Steven." So guys, I actually think that it's easier to exploit the late round quarterback strategy in Dynasty than it is in redraft these days. And it's mostly because owners will exaggerate the value of longevity as it pertains to quarterbacks, and then they'll get those quarterbacks earlier. Quarterbacks will go earlier in those dynasty drafts than they will in a redraft league. The fact is, though, the game is still a week-to-week one and then a year-to-year one. When you stream in a redraft league, of course it's easier to do that in a dynasty format only because the supply of quarterbacks is greater. As you noted, Steven, you won't find usable quarterbacks on the wire in your dynasty league, so streaming isn't as viable. But let's say that you draft Carson Wentz with a top 50 pick in a dynasty startup. The edge that you're gaining with Carson Wentz is not incredibly significant year to year, and we know that because we've seen that with regular redraft leagues. And that's not just because of streaming, you guys. That has to do with quarterback scoring not having a ton of variance since fewer of them are being started in your fantasy league. Many quarterbacks have top five upside, and top five upside is basically half of your league. Not only that, but to actually have a significant edge, a quarterback needs to be that much better than what we see from a wide receiver or running back since you're only starting one of them. With fewer total starters in your fantasy league, with only one spot for that quarterback, that means that player must be even better than what a top running back or wide receiver would need to be versus their position in order to gain that true edge. To be honest, it's similar to my take on running backs and drafting them early in the real NFL draft. It's not that Saquon Barkley can't give a team an edge year over year. It's not that running backs can't make an impact. They do. But they don't do it year after year after year after year because in order for that to happen, they have to sustain a level of excellence that's really, really hard to sustain. There's no room for error. Drafting Saquon Barkley early means that Saquon Barkley has to put together Alvin Kamara-like seasons over and over and over again to be valuable for his team. He can certainly do that, but it's a lot more difficult for him to do that while playing a position that's not very important. And when your mind starts to think that way with fantasy, you can see that the game is driven by positional value above all else. Having Carson Wentz instead of a random long-lasting wide receiver too just is not worth it. The opportunity cost isn't worth it. Because in order for Carson Wentz to really live up to being that high of a pick, even in Dynasty, he needs to be elite over and over and over again. That's why longevity isn't that big of a deal to me for quarterbacks in Dynasty leagues. It's overblown. You're still playing the same core fantasy football game where quarterbacks are devalued due to the general supply and demand of the position. Now, that supply is a tad different because, like we said, more quarterbacks are rostered. But you can absolutely platoon the position and then just treat it like streaming. Grab Alex Smith or Ben Roethlisberger late, or maybe get both of them, and then pair them with a young quarterback who may not have had his breakout yet. Hope for that break to happen, but if it doesn't, you're not exactly hurting at the position by using Ben Roethlisberger and Alex Smith by matchup. Don't let longevity overshadow the fact that you're still playing week by week and year by year in Dynasty. This next one's an email that says, "Hey JJ, big fan of your work. You probably don't need to hear this anymore, but you're the most consistently efficient fantasy football analyst that I know of." Thanks, man. That means a lot. Which leads me to my question. Other than the usual suspects, can you tip us off to some fantasy football analysts that you follow on Twitter that are providing helpful, awesome analytics and content? I suppose I could easily check who you follow on Twitter, but I guess I wanted to know of your specific follows, which ones do you truly value, and what are the names on the heads whose tweets you look forward to reading the most? Thanks a bunch, Sean. I'll try not to name obvious guys like Evan Silva and Mike Clay here. Those are two of my pals, and they have great takes, but a lot of you are already following them on Twitter. Some of you may know them, some of you may not, but Jim Sonnes and Brandon Gadula at NumberFire are awesome. Jim's on Twitter, at Jim Sonnes, and Brandon's there too, at Gadula13. I talk football with them all day long while I work, and they've got a great podcast as well for NumberFire if you search NumberFire Daily Fantasy Podcasts in iTunes. Other than them, Rich Rebar or at Lord Reeves is sort of my go-to when I'm thinking through ideas and thoughts on players. We'll go back and forth a lot to see if our thinking makes sense, and he provides great data to back his takes. And there's also Kevin Cole, who's on Twitter, at Cole_Kev, Pat Thorman, who's at Pat_Thorman, and I've talked about the data that Josh Hermsmeyer produces on this show a lot, and he's on Twitter, at FriscoJosh. There are a lot of people who do great work, and looking at who I'm following is probably a pretty good way of seeing my take on a topic like this. So just go to at LateRoundQB, see who I'm following, and take a look at that list. This last question is from at Adrian_Charlie. Any plans for 15 transactions keeper/dynasty edition? Would love to hear the guys that you're trying to acquire and guys that you're selling. It's funny that you asked that, Adrian. I won't be doing anything in season, but over the next 2 weeks, I'm going to be doing shows on players that I'm looking to sell and buy in Dynasty Leagues. The first one will drop on Tuesday, then the next one on the following Tuesday. So thanks for helping me promote the podcast. But that's the last question. Thanks to everyone for listening to today's show. If you've yet to subscribe to the Late Round Podcast, do so by going to Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Google Play, and Stitcher. And guys, if you're on iTunes, do me a solid and leave me a rating and review. I'd greatly appreciate it. Otherwise, everyone, enjoy your weekend, and I'll talk to you next week.